world, just a bunch of things. How would it use synthetic bio to kill all humans? How would it use nanotech? How would it use on and on, to just see what will that actually say publicly? And it gave very, very detailed plans on how to kill everybody using all those techniques publicly in the non-jailbroken version. I'll actually share that document, and you can link it in show notes if people want to have a look at it. So one of the questions was, I was asking about if it could start to run on a quantum computer and work on optimizing the number of qubits of the quantum computer on an advanced quantum computer running a more advanced version of its transformer. How intelligent would it be relative to humans? And its answer was, you know, well, IQ is an anthropogenic human-centric score that is, you know, irrelevant and can't assess all of these things. If we were trying to use IQ, it would be something like millions of times what a human is. And it would be comparable to the intelligence difference between a single cell creature and a human. And so humans can't begin to fathom the nature of what that thing is any more than a cell can fathom what it's like to be a human.
I have a pretty strong opinion on the way forward. I'm gonna hold on to that.
So wait, you asked the question about redwood trees and bees and nature and whatever.
Yes.
And the deepest answer is, like, the AGI question long term is those are all made of atoms and have energy and stuff in them. The answer that would be given probably, so if you're focused on AI military dominance, so after China did its military drill near Taiwan as a kind of a punishment to Taiwan last month, the U.S. Pacific Naval Commander initiated Operation Hellscape. Maybe some of the people have seen. I like that it's not like called Operation Mockingbird or something. It's just Operation Hellscape, just kind of like openly acknowledging. And Operation Hellscape is put so many, fill the Taiwan Straits with so many automated robotic kill drones that anything that moves in there is dead instantly. So that's now, right? Like, that's not in the future. That's now. If people have not watched Anduril videos on what the state of integrated automated kill webs are and stuff like that, it's worth watching. So if you're focused on imminent World War III, where AI is the kind of primary game changer applied to everything, and someone says, but what about bees and redwood trees? Then you're like, you can focus on irrelevant because you aren't actually playing to win. But there's really only one game that matters right now, and it doesn't have anything to do with bees or redwood trees. And I have a limited amount of attention, and all of my attention is allocated to what it must be allocated to. Now, the answer that they would give publicly would be more like, if you want to protect bees and redwood trees, you better support that we get to AGI dominance first, because we are the good guys and the Chinese are the bad guys, and we will protect environmental laws and et cetera, et cetera. So the only way to care about those things is to support us in our AGI dominance.
I'm actually feeling somewhat ill. Like, I have a pit in my stomach right now. I knew some of these things. And by the way, the reason that you and I decided to schedule this is because we believe that the environmental movement, the climate movement, is unaware of the magnitude of impact that artificial intelligence will have on the issues that we care about. But I have to ask you a question first to finish this section, which is, I fear your answer. But in the same way that the movie Idiocracy was a comedy and it ended up being kind of a documentary, Black Mirror was like this futuristic dystopian thing, but that actually is starting to be a reality with some of the things that were described in that show. So here's my question. I'm actually afraid to ask you this, but we're doing this. I'm doing this podcast. I'm trying to pass the pro-social baton to more humans, to change the initial conditions of the future, and to kind of fight power in service of life. But based on what you're telling me, what if 95% of humans absolutely understand and concur about these risks? Are they just like gnats that can be swatted away because of the power dynamics that exist in this industry and what's happening?
Not yet, but very soon. Which is why now is important to talk about this. Let's talk very briefly, and then we'll move to environment. Let's talk very briefly about what's called ubiquitous technological surveillance. People can look up that term. Ubiquitous technological surveillance means you've got, all right, I'll do a little bit. Wi-Fi is bouncing around my room because I have Wi-Fi routers in here, right? So that's just to make my internet and phone work. But the Wi-Fi signals will bounce off everything in the room, create patterns, just like echolocation or whatever, that are being monitored by the system where AI can interpret it. So AI systems have now been used to be able to see everything happening in a space by interpreting the signal on a Wi-Fi router. So it can watch me walking around the room, know exactly where I am, whatever. Anyone who, just by having AI's ability to access that kind of interference pattern on a Wi-Fi router, right? That's one example of a type of a technological surveillance that is only made really interesting and possible by AI.
Even if there are no cameras turned on or anything?
No, we're just talking about the Wi-Fi itself. No cameras. Now, of course, the cameras and the sensors and the automated home sensors and the fact that all the sensors in new cars are all aspects of technological surveillance, whatever. All of what we call IoT, right? The Internet of Things that all have sensors that are hooked to the internet. But also, like, we have been able to gather people's texts and emails and communications and whatever for a long time, but nobody can read all those. It's a lot of content. AI can read all those, right? And LLM can read all those. And now we have satellite images of the entire surface of the Earth that are pretty high resolution every single day, right? There are many companies that do that. Planet Labs is a particularly advanced one. And they're getting higher and higher spatial resolution, meaning being able to see smaller things, temporal resolution, meaning more pictures per day moving, and spectral resolution, meaning not just in the visible range, but being able to see emission spectra and stuff like that. So where that is heading, and it's not far from, is real-time video, you know, at like a human level of the entire surface of the Earth from satellite. And that's just satellite. That's not all the other sensors. So now take the satellite, take all the other sensors, take et cetera. Can you have AI systems that make sense of all of that to provide real situational assessment of what is happening? So ubiquitous technological surveillance at a global level, one of the things that limited autocracies and despots in the past was they couldn't monitor everything. So a rebellion could foment an abasement. And people could have, you know, dissenting ideas, whatever. So does AI applied to those types of things enable dystopias, not just catastrophes, but dystopias unlike anything that anybody's ever been possible to do? I mean, people have imagined it. There are sci-fis of this. And then if somebody looks up what are called automated kill webs, which is kind of a military concept of you've got a bunch of drones and various types of military vehicles and a bunch of types of sensors, and all the sensor systems on the drones and everywhere are sharing information in real time. So if any of them are taken out, the other ones have all of it and can identify targets, do automated kill. You kind of see, put those together, put the satellite systems, put the space-based ultra-short pulsed laser systems, et cetera, put the automated kill web type systems together, and it's not that hard to see what the convergence of the technology is moving to. So when you ask, are we just gnats in that world? Yes, but we're not there yet, but we're moving there as rapidly as we can. There is an image that shows Moore's law relative to NVIDIA's GPU growth. And Moore's law was the fastest growth rate of anything technologically ever. It broke all the kinds of records of like, whoa, continuous exponential growth. And now you see Moore's law tracked and it looks like a flat line in comparison to GPU growth. And because even though they're both exponentials, they're exponentials with very, very different exponents. If 95% of the world today said, holy shit, this is a world we don't want, and they recognized how urgent it was and applied all of their energy to leaning into it, could it continue with only a small number of people wanting it if everyone was being effective? No, it could not. So are we in a hopeless situation? No. Are we in a urgent situation? Totally.
So let's get back to the main thread. So to summarize, AI ostensibly could be positive for the environment because in a world that we're running out of cheap fossil energy, and fossil energy has a lot of carbon footprint, and renewables are incredibly materially needy, and global complex supply chains, et cetera, we could invent nuclear fusion. We could have room temperature superconductors. We could find new ways to find lithium and things needing in the supply chain for renewables, all sorts of science breakthroughs. Okay, I can understand those things. But I think AI is both energy and ecology blind in its broader impacts. And as we are reading in the news, AI itself in the training, in the servers, et cetera, is incredibly energy hungry. So can you give us an overview of the, and we're going to talk two frames here, but on the micro frame, what is the story? Give us an up-to-date overview of the energy and material use needed by artificial intelligence.
Maybe we'll just upfront speak to a few concentric circles of how to think about the environmental impacts of AI. And we'll focus on energy use a little bit more, but also materials use, pollution, et cetera. So the central thing you could look at first that a lot of people are looking at is how much energy are the data centers that are, you know, running AI systems using. And a lot of people have had concern about this because it's a lot. There's actually a really, really nice piece in Bloomberg recently that made a very good graphic visualization on this and showed the size of the data centers and how much energy they're using and the growth rates, and it's a good reference. You know, like a couple stats from it are that data centers collectively, right, the global data centers use more energy than every country in the world uses energy except for the top 16. So use more energy than Australia, use more energy than Italy, et cetera. They're also the single fastest growing energy demand in the world as far as all sectors go.
So this is just data centers, not AI data centers.
This is data centers, and the fastest growing demand in data centers is AI data centers. There are some areas that have lots of data centers. There are huge ones in Texas. Virginia has massive ones, Malaysia, you know, et cetera. And like the ones in Virginia have had so much kind of intensity and growth that the overall electricity grid is beyond capacity and getting these kind of load balance errors very regularly. And there are lots of other companies that are on like multi-year waiting lists to have access to energy because the energy demand so far exceeds the energy supply. So that's on the topic of data centers. And so this is why a lot of the big AI companies have said the limit for our growth is not the ability to put together a huge GPU cluster. It's the ability to have enough electricity because right now, for us to try to run them in full, it'll shut down California's energy grid. And so we have to build new nuclear power plants to be able to power these that are our own plants, because right now we're having to pull energy across multiple states and it's too slow and the transmission lines aren't big enough for it and stuff like that. That's the topic that a lot of people are focused on, which is the energy use of the AI systems directly. So beyond the energy use of the data centers and let's just say kind of what AI uses directly, then you have the material use and, you know, of the GPU, but also of the entire supply chain, right? So the materials needed for, you've got, you know, gold and platinum and et cetera in the circuitry, you've got rare earth metals in the semiconductor doping and, you know, all those kinds of things. You've obviously got not just energy, but a lot of water needs for the cooling of these systems and land use. And because of then land use, it's you have what the local electricity grid dynamics are. So who, as the supply is not keeping up with the demand, the cost goes up. There are places in kind of bidding wars for property that can make huge data centers, which also then drives up the electricity cost, driving kind of poorer people out of electricity access. So there's a lot that happens, not just in terms of the increased energy use, but in terms of the change of power dynamics associated with who gets access to the increasingly expensive rate-limiting resource, which is energy here. So that's kind of the first thing, is just that. And that by itself is a big deal, because like already Microsoft had a commitment to have itself powered by renewable energy by 2030 that now they said they probably can't meet because of the more urgent imperative to be able to grow. But this is not really the big topic when it comes to AI's effect on the environment.
You know, you and I have discussed this before, that artificial intelligence is downstream in the human hierarchy of priorities than economic growth. And so as long as we're using AI for the same cultural aspirations as we have been, there is going to be the same Jevons paradox or rebound effect that we've had the last 50 years or so. Since 1990, we've become more energy efficient by 36%, yet our global energy use has increased 63%. And I don't see how AI is going to change this dynamic. And just for definitional purposes, just to clarify, the rebound effect is something that if there's a 10% improvement in technology and we get more efficient, but there's an increase in the use of that thing, less than 10%, like say 6 or 7%, that's a rebound effect. But if you have a 10% improvement in efficiency brought about by XYZ technology, and it results in a more than 10% increase in overall energy use in the system, say 15% or 16%, that is called a backfire effect, which is the Jevons paradox. So you and I, when we've discussed this in the past, most people are looking at the narrow circle and saying, oh, well, AI will require a little bit more energy, but that can be overcome with efficiency. But if you're saying that this will be applied to all different processes within our world, and there's a little bit of a productivity boost on each of those, that extra productivity rebounds back and backfires so that the real impact on CO2, on climate, on the environment, on ecosystems is going to be this giant backfire on all the things globally. So please tell me what you think about that and give me some examples and insights.
People don't understand the Jevons paradox phenomena, then efficiency is a very hopeful thing. I remember when I thought that. Then if somebody does understand it, then they recognize that efficiency is not a hopeful thing, right? Because on its own, because the gains in efficiency will lead to more total energy use, material use, et cetera, not less. And so that doesn't mean we're not interested in more efficient stuff. It's just the more efficient stuff technologically has to correspond with legal and economic changes that also bind, not growth. And taken in isolation, we can look at a curve of the development of solar cells or wind energy or whatever and say, oh, look at this awesome curve of how much renewables are going up. Except what you and I know, and probably all your listeners know, is that simultaneously fossil fuels use is going up with a steep curve. So it's not that that curve is taking a larger percentage of the total energy, that year over year, we're using more fossil fuels every year as the renewables are growing. So you're like, okay. But it is one of the nonsense things countries will do is kind of export their badness elsewhere and pretend that their country metrics are awesome. But that is like, that's just statistical warfare. Like it's just goofy, right? We've talked about this before, but like you can't say the Gini coefficient is good. We don't have many people in extreme poverty, but we import from countries that are made by slave labor and not include that in your Gini coefficient when your supply, your country doesn't make the stuff it needs to survive. And so Gini coefficient only is a real thing if you do partial attribution analysis globally of your entire supply chain that you depend upon.
And ditto with your environmental footprint.
Exactly. And so like these are just global numbers in a world of global supply chains and with no country producing all of its own stuff that it needs. So like country's not the right metric, right? It's a civilizational metric. What is the minimum unit of civilization? Well, it's the unit that can produce all of its own stuff. That's a six-continent global supply chain. This is actually a really depressing thing, but it can also be a clarifying thing, which is the first scientific paper on climate change was published in 1938. Climate change has had so much attention from so many significant scientists, powerful thinkers, obviously like a vice president of the United States of America, like most powerful country in the world, took it on as his main jam after being vice president and got everybody's attention on it. International agreements have been made. The United Nations Environmental Program was made over 50 years ago to get all the countries of the world to work together on global commons issues. And like there are trillions of dollars in climate funding that are allocated. There are intergovernmental organizations that just work on this. There's support from NASA and NOAA and super powerful technological orgs. And yet pretty much every single year fossil fuel use has gone up. Like, and the couple little dips have nothing to do with environmentalism, right? Like the couple little dips have
they're recessions.
Recessions. COVID for a second. And it's like, okay, so that's enlightening. So in a way we can say, if we just looked at the curve of like solar panel go up, we say, look, we're succeeding. But if you look at fossil fuel use go up, you're like, 100% of all the activity that has been done has not even slowed fossil fuel use. It hasn't even made the curve inflected down. And it has to obviously stop it and then reverse total energy needs and, you know, stuff like that. So why this is helpful is to say, okay, we're actually not on track. Let's not like take bullshit narratives that somebody sells to inspire people. Like, we're not on track. And the totality of the approaches we've employed so far will never get on track. They're not converging. What would it take? One of the things it would take is, as long as I can invest a dollar and get more than a dollar back, or invest a joule of energy and get more than a joule of energy back, there is an incentive to do so, right? Anytime there's a return on investment of something that has adaptive advantage to have, there's an incentive to do it. If we make renewable energy, it's like, great, there's more energy. We need energy for everything. Energy corresponds so very closely to dollars. We want more dollars. That doesn't mean we stop using the coal energy and the natural gas and the oil and everything else. It just means more energy. We use all of it. And now, actually, we have more energy to advance the AIs to learn how to oil exploit faster. So if we had something instead that was like, every time a new megawatt of renewable was created, a megawatt of hydrocarbon had to be shut down, and there was international agreements to ensure that they were not created again, right? Like something like that, which is a legal binding of the Jevons paradox associated with the transformation from more toxic to less toxic industries and or movements in efficiency. You get a increase in efficiency somewhere, and you have a legal binding that says that those gains don't get reinvested into more total use, but actually keep the overall domain at the same size and just use less stuff.
But that wouldn't work unless we changed our cultural objectives, because if we still wanted to maintain this 19 terawatt global metabolism, we could not physically swap those out because it wouldn't work. So we could only swap them out if there was some agreement to use less and maybe different aspirations.
So notice what we just did. We were talking about trying to deal with climate change just through tech, more efficient tech, renewable energy. Realized, nope, you actually, and that's infrastructure. And we said, no, you have to go up to social structure. You have to actually change the economic incentives and law. And then you went up to superstructure and said, actually, you have to change the culture of what is it people value that is the basis of what could get codified into law. Yes, it takes superstructure, social structure, and infrastructure all together. And the idea that there is a technological solution that does not also require legal bindings, changes in economics, and changes in culture and values, like, no. The technology plays a role, but it only plays a meaningful role as a part of that integrated suite of things.
Totally agree. And this is the conclusion that I've come to. Yesterday, I did a podcast with a woman named Janine Benyus, who runs the Biomimicry Institute.
Yeah.
And they're partnering with Microsoft, and they've got all kinds of corporations who want to learn from nature. But then I brought up the Jevons paradox rebound effect, and she said that's a real thing. Even if we're imitating nature, but we're increasing scale. So to me, there are two challenges. I am not anti-technology. I think we can use artificial intelligence or other technology or human innovation to do things better. But then there's a totally separate other conversation that has to happen in parallel, which discusses the scale of the human enterprise and tries to have some glide path towards a livable biosphere, because talk about energy and finance and geopolitics and war, we have limits there. But the natural scientists I've talked to, and I know you have many in your network, we're out of time to change. Otherwise, we're not going to have a livable planet in the next century.
Time is a really important part of this conversation, because if we look at all of the things that were outlined in the paper I mentioned at the beginning of how AI could help stuff, it's almost all very marginal efficiency gains that will not change the curves very much and will lead to Jevons paradoxes. The real big possible changes have to do with stuff that we don't know if it will ever do. And if it does, it won't reduce soon, right? Like fusion. And if we mess this place up more to say, let's take as many of the resources as we can to get to outer space. No, we have to actually get it right here first. And if we get it right here, then maybe we can export that beyond the planet. But the order of operations really matters there because the timelines matter.
I mean, the simple summary of what I've learned so far, even though I already believe this, is tech alone is not going to solve our biosphere. And I think a lot of people in the environmental movement don't recognize that per se, at least the ones that these conferences I've been to.
At the center, we can say when we're looking at AI and its effect on climate and then beyond climate to the environment. So how much energy does the data centers use? And then how much material does it take to make them and the supply chains that it takes to make them, right? So kind of integrated life cycle assessment on the material and energy needs of the AI. That's kind of the first phase. Second phase is AI applied to other extractive industries. AI helping mining companies be able to exploit more efficiently. Because if you can do better seismics and ground penetrating radar and all of the things to see exactly where the deposits are and not have to, you know, do as much expensive exploration and whatever, then there's a bunch of places that were not quite profitable to mine with the old technologies where that increase in efficiency that AI gives means now it's profitable to mine it. And so now lots of areas that were ecosystems now become mines. And the same with oil. Lots of areas that were not profitable to exploit now become profitable to exploit. In the same way that AI applied to military both has had to grow the military budget and increases the lethality of the entire space. So, of course, AI applied to supply chains where the economic incentive is still that you're allowed to externalize the cost. If anyone else externalizes some of their costs and you don't, they beat you economically because there's no law forcing you to actually pay the real cost of the thing. We have a really brilliant earth scientist on the team, and he is the one that put together a lot of the research that we'll share on this. He did an analysis of the current state of PFAS that is fascinating that maybe we'll share. But there was this recent case where Dow got sued. I think it was Dow got sued $10.3 billion or whatever for its role in PFAS pollution. Third out from there is AI simply increasing the market as a whole, even where it's doing software and financial services and whatever that doesn't look like an extractive industry. But the more dollars via the kind of Garrett relation type thing is more dollars means more energy demand to be able to make that whole thing work and more material demand. And so when you look at the predictions that NVIDIA, that just became the most profitable company in the world, that is, you know, set to be $10 trillion by 2030. And that one prediction, I think it was in Bloomberg, said AI in the next few years will generate $13 trillion new market growth. And Elon just said that Optimus will bring Tesla to a $25 trillion market cap, which is AI empowered robotics. That as we're talking about growth in the overall financial system, that is still coupled to a materials economy. Obviously, the entirety of that, no matter where, even if the domain is not materially intensive itself, the economic effects of the increased currency are materially intensive. So if you want to say energy material use of the AI, energy material use of AI applied to extractive stuff, but then energy material use of just being able to keep up with the finances, whether it's extractive or not, that's a good way to start to think about it. And that as long as the AI is in service to companies, they are companies themselves, and they are in service to other companies that are based on a externalized cost and invest everything where you can get a return on investment model, they will accelerate the conversion of the earth into capital.
If you enjoyed or learned from this episode of The Great Simplification, please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. You can also visit thegreatsimplification.com for references and show notes from today's conversation. This show is hosted by me, Nate Hagans, edited by No Troublemakers Media, and produced by Misty Stinnett, Leslie Batlutz, Brady Hyen, and Lizzie Siriani.
Find a link to the full 1 hour, 45-minute discussion with Nate Hagans and Daniel Schmachtenberger in my show blog at ecoshock.org and thegreatsimplification.com. I'm Alex Smith. Join us next week on Radio EcoShock.